news broke yesterday that a planned mass shooting in Milwaukee had been thwarted by the FBI. Federal prosecutors are calling the planned attack on a Milwaukee Masonic Center a terrorist-style plot. Was intended to kill dozens of people with automatic weapons. The suspect is in custody.
That suspect is 23-year-old Sammy Mohammed Hamza. While details are still emerging about who he is, why he was planning this attack, we do know that he thought the shooting could bring global attention and spawn similar attacks as well.
Here with us now to talk more about what we know about the situation so far is John Diedrich. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he's been covering that story. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, this news yesterday seemed to come out of nowhere, but it's clear that this has been a long investigation. What do we know about how long the FBI had been working behind the scenes on this one?
Well, this unfolded in September. At that point, the FBI, according to the criminal complaint, received information that Mr. Hamza had discussed traveling to Jordan. He's a U.S. citizen, but has some ties to that country through his parents. And then he was planning to travel there and then try to pass into the West Bank, where he would attack both Israeli soldiers and civilians. The FBI started tracking him after getting that information, and according to the criminal complaint, he later turned his attention, meaning within a month, to hitting a target, attacking a target, or planning to attack one here in the United States. Specifically, he settled on a Masonic center here in Milwaukee, according to the criminal complaint.
And what do we know about the suspect, other than what you shared about how he first popped up on the radar? What do we know about him personally?
Well, he's been in Milwaukee for about 5 years. We've spoken to a number of friends and family who describe it, just are shocked by the charges and detail in the criminal complaint and the extensive recorded conversations in which he talks about this attack. They say this is an individual who had supported his family. He's working mostly menial jobs, delivery service, things of that nature. Had worked out at had been a personal trainer, a job from which he was fired, but had worked a number of jobs. Apparently was a partier, not particularly religious, and they're shocked by this particular information that there isn't any criminal history in his background. So they did not see this as being part of his character at all.
An acting U.S. attorney referred to this case as a detailed plan to commit a mass shooting intended to kill dozens of people. Specifically, what do we know about that plan?
Well, so what had happened, where there were a couple individuals who were close to Mr. Hamza, specifically, they're not named in the criminal complaint, but they were people that appeared to be known to him, and they were recording him secretly, and they discussed plans, and Mr. Hamza's comments in this are detailed in the criminal complaint, in which he detailed attacking this Masonic Center in downtown Milwaukee. It's not entirely clear why he chose that target, though. He spoke broadly in the complaint about them being responsible for hardships suffered by Muslim people and so forth. So he outlined a plan in which he and these two other individuals would use fully automatic weapons with silencers. They would sweep into the building and kill the first people they saw sort of quietly and swiftly, and then move room to room, killing everybody, anticipating that they would kill about 30 people. And that estimate seems to come from the fact that he and the others toured the Masonic Center last week. This was a day in which they also went to the shooting range and then gathered after that to talk in depth about the plans to attack the center. And then he was arrested on Monday when he actually took possession of two fully automatic weapons from the FBI, along with the silencer.
So to be clear, the so-called accomplices were undercover agents. There are not any other known associates that we know of.
Well, they're not identified as agents, but rather confidential informants. So we don't know whether they were existing friends of his or individuals who were introduced to him through this process, and that's going to be examined by his defense, which is mounting now, exactly what the nature of it is. The FBI agents, the undercover agents, they came in when the actual sale of the machine guns occurred. And that's what the friends of Mr. Hamza are pointing to, is they said, well, he didn't have any guns until the FBI, you know, provided the guns, so he didn't have the means, they're saying, to conduct this attack until the FBI provided it. From the FBI side of it, though, and the federal prosecutors, their point is that there was plenty of discussion about this, and then actions, touring the center, going to the shooting range, and then going ultimately and buying these weapons, that backed up the talk that he was serious about this attack.
We're talking right now to John Diedrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's joining us to talk about the FBI's thwarting of a planned mass shooting in Milwaukee. What kind of charges could the suspect be facing at this point?
Well, right now he's charged by criminal complaint with possessing a fully automatic weapon and a silencer. Both require a special permit under federal law, neither of which he had. And he's charged by criminal complaint in the federal system that allows authorities to take him into custody, and he's being held without bail in detention right now. But they have to bring this case before the federal grand jury in Milwaukee within the month. And we're hearing now that's going to be early February that he'll be brought the case will be brought before the grand jury. At that point, the additional charges could be brought. Now, the federal prosecutors have not referred to this as a terrorism case. There's reasons for that, though that does not mean that terrorism charges may not be coming, and that's certainly within the purview of federal prosecutors to add additional charges. But the straight-ahead charges, the very obvious ones, are possession of a fully automatic weapon and silencer, contrary to federal law.
The mayor yesterday, Mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, was asked if he thinks there are any other remaining threats stemming from this case. So what did he say?
Well, at this point, they don't have any other individuals that are identified as being connected with Mr. Hamza. It's sort of the classic scenario of a lone wolf. And he, in fact, talks in the complaint about how he hopes this attack is going to trigger broader attacks across the U.S., but he specifically says, we're not part of Hamas. So he says, you know, essentially we're on our own here. We're our own group. And since two of those three individuals were actually cooperating with the FBI, at least from the criminal complaint, it appears as though there is really, and the case really circled, you know, and rested upon him. That said, you know, there are, and there was a case not that long ago in which an individual who spent some time in Milwaukee ultimately traveled to Syria and fought there and then came back to the United States. He's now charged with lying about a terrorism act. But that case is not particularly connected to this, as we know, but it's instructive in that, you know, these cases are not just, you know, being found in New York and L.A. and larger places, but Milwaukee's possibility for this as well, and that's what law enforcement said, is these kinds of threats potentially could come up here in the Milwaukee area as well as a larger city.
And John, just briefly as we wrap up, the FBI doesn't generally speak out about foiled attacks. They usually seem to get veiled references in a political speech later. Why is this one so public?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, every case is different, and the FBI will say frequently, you know, we've deterred or ended, you know, many attacks that don't haven't been able to take hold, if you will, because there may be other investigations that spawn out of those and so forth. But, you know, there's a number of attacks that have been foiled, the shoe bomber and others, where individuals, you know, attempted to launch an attack and were foiled for various reasons. And when they can, they criminally charge them, and then they tend to talk about them because there's a lot that they can't talk about, and so they want to bring the facts out that here's what we're doing.
And we leave it there. John, thanks for joining us. It was John Diedrich, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
The Iowa caucuses are just 5 days away. It's the end of a many month-long process in which politicians vying for their party's nomination flock to Iowa. They eat the snacks at the Iowa State Fair, speak at the town halls, and visit local businesses.
But why does a state with just 3 million people and a demographic out of sync with the diversity of the country have so much sway over the political process?
Our next guest says, in some ways, it's good to shine a spotlight on Iowa now because the challenges facing that state are fundamental to many of the ones facing the whole country.
Joining us now is Richard Manning, journalist and author of the Harper February cover article called The Trouble with Iowa. The story was produced in collaboration with FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you hit the campaign trail in Iowa. What kinds of issues were you looking to uncover when you went there?
Well, when I went into the story, I kind of had a sense of what I would be looking at, and it's the usual suspects when you're working with ag issues, and usually that has to do with the environment, but also the quality of the food. But as you start teasing out those issues and looking at them, they take you almost immediately to some of the larger issues that affect the rest of the country, all of us, every single day, especially things like health care, the obesity problem, but oligarchy, corporate control, distribution of wealth, poverty, immigration, all those things crop up almost immediately.
And there's been some criticism about how Iowa packs so much punch when it doesn't necessarily look a lot like the rest of the country. Can you make the case that Iowa is actually a good snapshot for the issues facing the entire country?
Well, usually that's based on the population. People look at the population and say, well, it's 3 million farmers and they're all white. And that's not quite true, but it's close to true. But on the other hand, it first of all begins the process of agriculture. I mean, it's where we do industrial agriculture in the nation. So a lot of our problems begin there. But it also looks like the rest of the nation in many ways. For instance, I talked a lot about water quality in the story because that's really the big issue with farming these days. But the kind of things that are happening there look very much like what's happening in Flint right now, Flint, Michigan, with a different set of issues, but the inability to regulate and the unwillingness to regulate on the part of a governor is very much part of the whole picture. So they have the same problems but different problems, but it still looks like the rest of the country in some very important ways.
Well, right, and you do start off looking at water pollution, and now it's even more timely with the news about Flint. And in Iowa, the issues are more of hog manure than nitrates getting into the water. How does that intersect with Iowa's biggest cash crop, which is corn?
Yeah, first of all, it's from the corn itself to begin with. And if everybody looks at the CAFOs, the hog factories, and of course they play an enormous role in Iowa. There are 21 million hogs there. But if we go upstream of that, they're raising corn on something like corn and soybeans on 24 million acres of their cropland there. And nitrogen fertilizers are flowing off that land in abundance. And that begins the pollution process, both phosphorus and nitrogen off those fields. And, of course, then the hog manure adds to that almost the same things, more nitrogen, more phosphorus. So the two things together are actually three things. There are chicken farms doing the same thing, and chicken CAFOs, and 50 million chickens in the state. All those things together are the equivalent, really, just the hogs alone are the equivalent of 45 million people without sewage treatment. And that's really an enormous burden on the streams.
You point out that not having drinkable water is often a quality of a third world country, and that we should look more closely at this. And now we've got Flint to look at as well. So what does Iowa tell you about what's gone with cleaning up water?
Well, it's not Iowa alone. I mean, I can find that situation almost anywhere I choose to look where there's farming. And that's across most of the nation. So really, industrial agriculture over the last 20 years or so has greatly ramped up its use of nitrogen. Iowa has raised pigs and corn since the Civil War, but their water was drinkable up until about 15 years ago. So this is a relatively new development. But what really tells us is the inability to regulate. And I think that's the larger issue. And why it becomes like Flint, but a lot of other problems elsewhere in the nation, and that the right wing and business and so forth have invested a whole lot of effort and time and really a movement of about 40 or 50 years now to really undermining environmental regulation, all regulations, but certainly environmental regulation. And we're finding that almost anywhere we go, especially in the red states where we do the production and things like that.
Well, you do say in the piece that there's a simple problem to some of this, and this is funneling some of this water to be treated in wetlands and some crop fields that could no longer be used for corn. So what's happening there with the politics that's preventing the solution?
Yeah, that was probably the most surprising thing I encountered in looking at the water pollution problem, because we think of these problems as huge and unsolvable in some way. But I actually spent time with a scientist who devised a solution. He says, you know, if you give me 10% of this landscape, I could really solve the problem immediately. Well, 10% is really quite small, especially when you consider that some of his solutions would continue the productivity on that 10%. So in other words, they produce food on some of those acres. And it seems even smaller still when we understand that 40% of our corn crop is now going into ethanol. So in other words, we're pouring it into gas tanks. And we can certainly forego that production on some level. So it's easy to do, but agriculture, industrial agriculture, is like an engine with the throttle wired open now. Everything runs full blast all the time. And so they're really unwilling to give up that 10% or even talk about paying the cost of their own pollution.
We're talking to Richard Manning right now, journalist and the author of Harper's February cover article. It's called The Trouble with Iowa, looking at how the agricultural issues playing out in Iowa right now can be seen as a microcosm for what we see as politics and agriculture issues in the rest of the country. And you mentioned the ethanol there and the subsidies. People there, many of them might say that those subsidies are important to Iowa's economy. So what do you do then about that?
Well, they're massively important to Iowa's economy, but we're paying about $10 billion a year in farm subsidies in this country nationwide. Most of it goes to four or five crops. Actually, four. So soybeans and corn lead the list there. And then if we throw in hay and wheat, we've got most of the subsidy picture in the United States. You know, that's a pretty big commitment on the part of our government. And we ought to do some social good with that commitment. And we could spend that money doing that subsidy to steer in other directions, to clean up the water, certainly, and to grow some alternative crops and maybe even make life a little bit better in the countryside. In rural areas where we've so industrialized agriculture, it might as well be a factory where people are working. So we can use that money much, much more wisely than we are now.
And how have the candidates for president, been navigating that issue?
Well, they don't, with one exception. And that was, I thought, really fascinating and another example of how Iowa is really a microcosm of what's going on nationally. So very early on, Ted Cruz came out against the ethanol, and no longer a subsidy, by the way. It's called the Renewable Fuel Standard. It's a requirement. But at any rate, he opposed that, and that's supposed to be political suicide in Iowa. And it's always been thought that way, and in both all the rest of the Democratic and Republican candidates, both are supporting that. And so it's been interesting to watch what's happened to him over time, and especially over the last couple weeks. The mainstream Republicans in the state have really come out of their neutrality and come out against Cruz for that very thing. So what we see there is, you know, the kind of the pro-business country club Republicans trying to discipline and bring the Tea Party evangelicals into line. And the jury's still out on how that's going to work out. But it's fascinating to see that little bit of a fight play out in Iowa.
Richard Manning is with us right now. He's a journalist and the author of the Harper's February cover article. It's called The Trouble with Iowa. As we get close to the Iowa caucuses, he's saying that the challenges facing Iowa, particularly in agriculture, are small scale of what the country is dealing with at large.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about industrial agriculture, like he's talking about here in Wisconsin or in Iowa, if you're there? What do you think of Iowa's significance in the elections process? Are you in Iowa? What do you think about the issues our guest is raising? Can you drink the water where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation right now with Richard Manning, journalist and the author of this month's cover article in Harper's Magazine. It's called The Trouble with Iowa. And he says that while many see Iowa as having too much influence over the political process, it might make sense because the challenges facing that state represent the challenges of the country.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Iowa has too much influence over the election process? What do you think about these industrial agriculture issues our guest is raising in Iowa? But not just in Iowa, here in Wisconsin as well. It's an issue across the state. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Willem on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. Yeah, about the industrial farming, you know, the politicians are always talking about small family farms, but really all the subsidies and all the help goes to these big industrial farms. In Kewaunee County in Wisconsin, a third of the private wells are contaminated because of these huge dairy farms, and around where I live, there's many of those, and they're spreading millions of gallons of liquid manure onto fields. And in Bayfield County, there's a proposed 60,000 hog farm that's going to threaten the water in that part of the state, which a watershed that flows into Lake Superior. So the water is really under threat by these. Like you said, they're called farms, but they're really factories.
Willem, thank you so much for that. And Willem pointing to issues that he sees here in Wisconsin. Do you think that, Richard, that these issues are applicable and are getting more play across the nation because, you know, there's articles like this and the candidates are there? Maybe there'll be a spotlight.
Yeah, to a degree they are. And oddly enough, it's taking off in Iowa. There's a lawsuit that I talk about in the story that is actually viewed as kind of the cutting edge on really correcting these problems. But the problem that the caller referred to is really pretty ubiquitous. It's everywhere in the nation, and I'm not surprised to hear that kind of commentary. I mean, everywhere I go where there's industrial agriculture, people are talking about this and talking about it in exactly the terms that we just heard.
Are politicians, as they're on the stump in Iowa, are they allowed to go in depth on these issues? Are they allowed to critique and still survive in the caucus?
They're allowed to, and we would certainly encourage and hope they would, but they don't. And that's the interesting thing, and that's what I expected when I went into Iowa, that here are these problems that are occurring in the fields that they're standing next to. They're literally standing in the fields where the problems are happening, and they're oblivious to them, like most of the nation is oblivious. So the lawsuit I just mentioned with Des Moines water system, and it's the entire city's water system is threatened by this pollution. That lawsuit is not mentioned in the national campaign, but you can certainly have a conversation about it with anybody in the state locally and in a local politician as part of it. But I thought the most ironic example, my favorite example of how the presidential candidates ignore these issues was Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush made a point of slimming down before he went on the campaign trail by going on the paleo diet. Now, I happen to think that's the right thing to do. I mean, and because you're avoiding the high carbohydrate diet that comes from industrial agriculture, and it makes you a lot healthier in a hurry. And there are other ways to do it. I'm not endorsing a paleo diet. But he mentions not a word of this during the campaign. So when something is so profoundly important to him as a person that he would do it to literally reshape his body, and then he won't talk about it in the campaign, I think avoids and really avoids a chance to do public education that what campaigns ought to be about. We ought to be talking about these issues.
And we go to another caller right now at 800-642-1234. We've got Greg on the line in McGregor, Iowa. Greg, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm a grass farmer. I haven't used any chemicals on my land since 1983. I produce a lot of local beef, grass-fed organic, and the speaker's right on that, we have to filter our own water here on the ranch so that we can drink it. It's high in nitrates, and Lord knows it's got every farm chemical that you can dream of in it. None of these politicians, including Iowa politicians, want to talk about clean water because that would fly in the face of mainstream agriculture, and you just can't do that here in Iowa. Even farmers don't talk about it amongst each other when they know it's killing everybody, including themselves. Their wives and their children dying of cancer, and they think that's the only way we can produce, and it definitely isn't. Iowa State University, Land-Grant College, a big chemical proponent, their organic plot regularly out-yields the conventional plots there at Iowa State. But you don't see that brought out in the news either.
Greg, what do you think it would take for people to start talking about the issues that you're describing?
I suppose it's going to take somebody that doesn't want to win very bad but want to lift out issues. I was kind of hoping that I saw Bernie Sanders in Decorah Sunday, and I was kind of hoping he would talk about it. But he's got quite an agenda of items he was talking about already that probably puts him at risk to some of the Iowa voters as far as their preference. But,
and, Greg, before we let you go, you're on the ground there in Iowa. Are you going to be involved in the caucuses at all on Monday?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be at my local caucus for Bernie Sanders, you betcha.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. And Richard, what do you make about that call?
Yeah, that's a really interesting call because, first of all, the caller does grass-fed beef. And I think that is one of the solutions, that we can do so much with grass-fed to do a lot of environmental good and make people healthier. It so happens Wisconsin's a leader in that. About 30% of the dairy now and Wisconsin is grass-fed, and that's far above any other state as far as I can tell. I also have a wonderful program at the University of Wisconsin at Madison that Dick Cates teaches and does a great job with. So that's very cool to hear that talked about there, and that's going to bring a market-driven solution to some of these problems that we're talking about.
And as we wrap up, Richard, you said in your piece that, and here's a quote, there is no doubt that conservatives would like to win the presidency, but they don't actually need to. What do you mean by that?
Well, they've invested a lot of time and money in state politicians. And so they're able to undermine and duck out of regulation, and they're very good at it. So we can pass a law in Washington, and they can ignore it. And that's really the way the country works now. They have rewired our political system. So when somebody in Washington turns the switch to turn the light on, in Iowa, the light goes off. It's that dramatic, and they're very good at it. And while they would like to have the presidency, they understand that they can do these things no matter who is president. They did indeed do them while Obama was president and was really trying to rein them in some ways.
And, Richard, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Richard Manning, journalist and the author of the cover article in Harper's this month. It's called The Trouble with Iowa. He joined us to talk about why the issues in Iowa may be a snapshot of the business of politics in the nation.